Okay. Yeah. Happy 4th. You know what's funny is we did, the last one we did was on, what, Memorial Day or something?
I know. We're just...
is there a holiday in roughly a month? Like that we can... No, it probably isn't. I don't think
we are your go-to holiday podcaster Q&As. So...
any 4th plans?
No, we did our kind of cookout yesterday, which, you know, Saturday's a better day. It means I can have this, like, slow, recuperating, hangover cup-sized cup of water here.
You have the the green
screen. The exact green screen cup, yeah.
And I love that you aren't using a green screen, so there's no purpose for that except for when you hold a cup. Bobby Bonilla Day. I saw that on the old news the other day.
Yeah, that ties in. If you haven't heard my baseball lecture, I mention Bobby Bonilla Day. That's all patrons have access to it, so you can go find it. Yeah.
We should maybe sometime we got to do a main show baseball law on that. Cause it's so funny. And what's funny is it surprises me every time. Cause I, you know, obviously I know vaguely about Bobby Bonilla Day, but then every time it's like, and he'll still keep getting it until like 2037 or some crap. Yeah. I'm like, how is it that long? Unbelievable. He hasn't played forever. So interesting.
The best part. Just spoiler on my lecture is this is not even the worst contracts that, you know, one of the worst, it's one of the worst, but it is not the worst contracts the Mets have handed out. So, belongs to Yoenis Cespedes for some inexplicable reason.
That'd be interesting to do a like worst contracts in baseball show. I bet. I mean,
you're
frozen.
No, I'm not.
Someday, I can hear you, but your video's frozen.
Oh, well.
Someday, you know what you should do, Andrew? You've already got the hole in the wall. Run a Cat 5 cable. Are we still on Cat 5? How many cats are we on? Do we have 6 cats yet? We always have like tech people. We always have like Bill Gates in the chat that always knows everything. Are we up to Cat 6? Anyway.
I have no idea.
Run a network cable through that hole you already conveniently punched in the wall.
And that is really that just works. I mean, I know you can't quite tell, but it is really just peeling paint, right? There was a TV bracket right here. It got pulled off. And so this delightful, like,
the chat is saying you were only frozen for me. Okay.
Yeah.
That's very weird. Why would
think all of your, you know, complaints about my audio are non-objective.
Hey, do you remember last time when he actually dropped everybody? Couldn't have just been me. That's weird that it would freeze you for me. Okay. Well, now I've learned. All right, let's get to the questions, everybody.
Let's do it.
If you had a boat, what would you name it from some anonymous questioner? All right, I'm going to see how much I respect our audience. Like, what are the odds that if I click load 3 replies, there will be a Bodie McBoatface in here?
100%.
I'm hoping not.
Okay.
Give me no Bodie McBoatface. There it is.
Yep.
I knew it. I knew somebody would make the Bodie McBoatface.
International Waters and I like Unsinkable that. 2 are two
Yeah,
great
there you go. Thanks for the real suggestions. Bodie McBoatface. Okay. Bodie McBoatface Esquire. All right. You know what? You won me back. I mean, I was the joke. I'm a little against reusing the same joke over and over and over that somebody else made. But Bodie McBoatface Esquire is, you improved
that's
on
clever.
It. So never mind. Yep. I take everything back. Good stuff. Do we really have Cat 7 and 8? Wow.
Apparently. Yeah.
That's cool. All right. Stormy. I haven't even had time to read this question.
So what would you name your boat, Thomas?
For sale. The highest bit with my phone number.
You had me at for sale, the SAIL. That would be,
that's good too. No, I literally was like, I'll name it for sale. Somehow I ended up with a boat. Please buy it from me. Cash. That'd be the name. I have no interest in a boat. I'm the least boat person that there could possibly be. I don't know why. I don't want to own one.
I would have to. I travel back in time and like, you know, use the Biff Tannen, like bet on sports things to get the level of wealthy, to own the only kind of boat that I would want to own. Right. Oh, which like would be yacht. One of those luxury yachts.
Yeah.
Right? Like, There's, trust me on this, there is not enough money in private law practice and vetting dick jokes and podcasting to get the kind of boat that
I want. Alex Lowe said it here. Oh, I can share these, huh? There we go. Yeah, no, this is always the thing. Like, if you're the, if you're the chump of your friend group that owns a boat, that means you've paid for a boat, one. Then you got to store it somewhere. Like, that's a pain in the ass. You're not using it a lot. Like, stuff like that really reminds you how little you use it, you know, when you're like, God, you know, I have a boat that I'm paying to store, you know, I've never used it. So I've never messed with it. I'm not even a boat person anyway. Although, if I live closer to the ocean, maybe, but the you know, the bodies of water around here, I'll tell you this. They are rivers, like the American River and the Sacramento River, which due to the drought and the just the amount of water that there isn't, are just infested with E. coli. So, like, there's – seriously, we keep getting, like, you know, there will be a little notice.
That's unpleasant.
Yeah. Like, don't swim in these because the water is so low that, like, I guess the water to disgusting E. coli ratio is bad. So, anyway, that's why I'm not a boat person. All right. Haven't even read this, but it's stormy. It's got 21 hearts. Thanks to everybody who asked questions and also hearted the questions you want to hear.
Yeah.
If you were to represent me in signing a deal challenging the devil to a fiddle contest with the standard stakes, I like that. What's the legal term for that, Andrew? Like the
boilerplate, right?
Yeah, boilerplate.
We've incorporated by reference herein.
Yeah, it would be like the stakes at common law, you know, like the assumed stakes for a devil's bargain, right? Is there, if the terms weren't specified, Andrew, this would be what they would assume. You know, like, is that with wills or whatever they do that? Like, if it's not specified, they assume, like, certain things.
Yeah, and that's a little different than boilerplate.
Oh, okay.
But yes, right. Yeah.
So anyway, boilerplate, standard stakes, fiddle of gold versus soul. What kinds of clauses would be most important to include, assuming that the devil is willing to comply with American jurisprudence? Oh, that's fantastic.
I love the question. We love you, Stormy. So a couple thoughts here, actual real thoughts. The first is virtually every deal with the devil, right? And now I'm thinking, you know, Futurama, right? TV show, movie, whatever.
I thought you were talking about your law experience. Like, okay, I have litigated, let's see, 20 years of devil litigation.
In the seventh circle of hell, that's, you know, the seventh circle.
That's a more liberal one.
Yeah, right? Yeah. You get a three demon panel there. But no, like most, you know, Fry, you smelly idiot. I think he wants to make some kind of deal with the devil with you, right? Most of those are like they disregard kind of the fundamental principle of contract, right? The same thing for, you know, genie wishes, right? Like all of these are premised on the idea that, like, you know, you'll say, oh, you know, we're going to slip some kind of term or second meaning or whatever into the contract that's not remotely what the parties intended, right? You know, again, the Futurama, there were two episodes, right? There was the holophoner.
It's been a while since I've seen those. Yeah. The holophoner one is the one I remember.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the robot devil, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So
but right. It's always a thing that is technically permitted by the contract.
Yeah.
Right. Monkey's paw is, I think the greater area. And like, the law is contract law is meant to be the opposite of the monkey's paw, right? Like it's supposed to do what you intend regardless of what you actually say. So I think that would be a really fun, like, you know how we will rewrite Law to Awful Movies. I think it would be a really fun rewrite to do like a non-monkey's paw kind of deal with the devil movie where
we should do one, you know, like it's a monkey's paw and then the person like successfully appeals up through the courts to like get the thing back. Oh my God, the cup is so
well
funny.
And that's and that's the thing is so the if this were standard deal with the devil contract, right? The most important thing would be to figure out like what, you know, the dispute and appeals resolution process.
Yeah. Someone said, well, on Patreon, someone said, who judges the contest? Cause yeah, I mean, typical fiddling with the devil, you know, like how I always wonder that. I think that in historically, it seems to be that the devil, if you beat him bad enough, he realizes it, you know, And he's like, you got me. You know, it seems to have some integrity to that. But I, you know, who knows if you're dealing with that kind of devil or not. You want to, you want, that's why you want to write it in to the contract. You don't want to trust the devil.
Roger, so I have two thoughts more on this. And, you know, we might as well stick with devil law since it's, you know, the 4th of July here. Roger Rosansky says, Bedazzled is a pretty solid deal with the devil movie. Yeah, the Elizabeth Hurley, I mean, you know, prime Elizabeth Hurley.
Oh, man.
It's hard to go wrong with that. The original Bedazzled, right, which was a British movie, was the one I saw, like, on airing on, like, you know, the Thursday afternoon movie, you know, when I was like 10 years old. And it was the first one that really got me thinking about atheism. And what, and so what's happening is the devil and your schlub protagonist are walking down the streets in London, and they have those little 3 foot high barricades, right? And he's asking, he's like, come on, like, why did you, you know, rebel against God? And the devil's like, all right, here's, we're going to do this. And he climbs, and the devil climbs up on the little pedestal, and he's like, I'd like you to dance around this pedestal and sing about how great I am. Right. And so the protagonist is like, yeah, okay, boy, you're fantastic. You look really good up there. I bet it's a nice pet. And then after like 30 seconds, he's like, hey, man, can we switch places? And the devil goes, see, that's what I said. And it was just this great moment. Anyway, so that was sort of, go ahead.
This is so weird that we've never had this problem. So Andrew is not freezing for you guys. It's just me. How would that possibly be? That is the weirdest thing.
I don't know.
It's throwing me off. Oh, well. Let's go to, here's another one. Sakashite Fukusumi, if unvaccinated sperm isn't the next Bitcoin, I need Eli's help to resell all these buckets. Asks, why are the state bans on teaching of CRT not being challenged on First Amendment grounds? Incidentally, first real non-placeholder question. Stick that up your pipe and smoke it, Teresa. Yeah, you know, ignore that. You know, like, that's, Teresa didn't do a placeholder. She, you know, she had it right away. This is the funny thing. Every single time I've thought about us talking about this, I'm mad that I didn't ask you this, and then I forget every time. So, yes.
Yeah, they will. It's a super simple answer. That if they have not already been challenged as non-content neutral regulations, right? And it is, you don't even have a, like, typically the problem you have in the educational context is, you know, you're challenging like a school policy or inviting a campus speaker. And the question is, like, how much do we impute to state action? I mean, here, this is legislation. Like, there is zero chance. All this is doing is, this is James Lindsay fucking up your tax dollars, right?
Wow. So. Yeah. Okay, so it sounds like I don't have enough cats in my cable. I need a cat.
Yeah.
Cat 7, 8, 9. I mean, I have a lot of cats, so I ought to be able to do something about that. You know, I wonder if it's, I recently messed with my router to try to, like, prioritize the TV because it kept freezing. Because we have YouTube TV. I wonder if I messed up. And maybe that's what happened.
Dominic Nardozzi says, I think this is the smoothest video audio has been in a live stream I've attended.
I think it is your
smooth jazz, sexy voice. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, if someone's going to go ahead and ask me a question like this, I'm going to go ahead answer it. Xavier Branch asks, Thomas, you mentioned you play hockey. What position do you play? Any awesome stories you'd like to share? None that would be interesting. I'll tell you this. I mean, they're fun for me. But so I play, the position I'm best at is center. I'm really good at taking faceoffs. I mean, at the level I'm at anyway. And also, tend to be a hustler out there. So center takes a lot of hustling. You gotta play D. You got to break out the puck. You got to be ready to get that breakout pass and go down the ice. But like this is not interesting. I'm trying to think what's the most interesting short thing I could say about this. I tend to be on team. I still haven't figured this out. If anybody could, you know, like, model this out, I tend to be on teams every single season that do well in the regular season and then get crushed in the little playoffs that we have. And I just, purely on a human level, I want to figure out what's happening. Like, why am I on that team for 10 years, every team I've ever been on? Like, It's like the other teams all have these players that don't play during the regular season. You know, they like play just the number of games they need and then come for the playoffs and play way better. It's the weirdest thing.
Well, that was going to be, if you couldn't come up with an example, the story of the most interesting hockey story you've told me off the air, right? Which is that year after year, you're on these teams where your opponents in the playoffs will like bring in somebody who like played AAA goalie for, you know, a couple of years or whatever
every
it is now.
Time.
Yeah. Right.
not a once have I done, but like I have won one championship, and it was back when I was at a lower level. And like I've had teams that were first all year and then just lose like right away in the play. It's so frustrating. I don't know what it is. And like part of me is like, oh, is it because I go to every game? So like we don't get better than we are in the regular season. But it's not like that would make us better if I didn't go to every game in the regular season, and then we would just be a lower seed and then suck. And you know,
Thomas's recipe for success:
weirdest.
play less.
Yeah,
less anyway. Thomas.
The other the other embarrassing story about this is that I've cut my own thigh with my skates three times now. Twice, once really bad, I have some ugly scars. Once quite bad, and once not very bad, but still just enough to have a little scar. Pretty crazy. I have no idea how I've done it three fucking times. All right. Oh wait. Somebody asked you on baseball. Do you want to share what position you ever played on baseball?
Sure. Yeah, I was a second baseman and pitcher. Which you're gonna get there right in about 5 or 6 years. All of a sudden, it will be way more fun telling stories about your kids playing sports.
Oh, yeah.
Than about
easily.
You playing sports. And you know, it's I could talk about Alex. We finally this season, you know, he dropped down to a for the past couple of years. We didn't play in 2020, and he dropped down to a to a rec league, and it's just it is so much fun when you have like kids who, right, they all love playing baseball. You don't have anybody who's like, you know, picking flowers in right field anymore because it's at the high school level. But like, you know, and some of them, some of the kids who play also are on the high school team. Mm. But like, you know, there's less. You never get to zero like bullshit from parents and coaches. But there's less, right? And you know, so in the they had a doubleheader that was basically the playoffs, and they like moved kids around to like all the positions that they never play. And so he was mostly, you know, shortstop and pitcher over the regular season. So, you know, he caught four innings, like, and I felt really bad because literally the first pitch that came in, he, you know, put his glove up and it ricocheted off his glove and like smacked the ump in the face.
Oh, man.
And the ump was like wandering around like really, really mad. And then, you know, talked to us after the game and was like, so you usually pitch, I'm guessing you don't catch a lot. And Alex is like, I have never caught before.
And the ump was like,
I recommend not doing that.
Yeah. So, wow. Yeah, no, it's already way more fun to tell stories about my kids, obviously. That's all I like doing. Yesterday we went to, you know, my brother's he has a pool and we did some swimming. Mm-hmm. And the kids, you know, Phoebe's always been really nervous with the pool, you know, she kind of let me take her in when she was a baby a little bit, but she was always scared. And, you know, Arlo has just been the fearless. They couldn't be more archetypal. You know, Phoebe is the nervous, aware of everything going on, like knows everything happening. Arlo is oblivious to just about everything. He just wants to do what he wants to do, and he just doesn't care about anything else. And so we were swimming, and this is his first time, I think, swimming at all, you know, and he wasn't scared. He didn't want to go in right away, but we put him on a raft. He and Phoebe were on a raft, and he has so little fear and awareness that he just kamikaze'd off the raft. Like, he just... he like was trying to reach something and was just like, oh, and just bam, straight in the water. And so obviously I snatched him up right away, just that it was the kind of thing that Phoebe would never have done in a million years. And he was just like, oh, what's this? Oh, you know, straight into the water. Oh, man.
That's
Roger,
so good.
We actually did play Tippin at Sam's Pool. It's the most fun. All right. I think is our first real substantive question.
Okay.
It's a holiday. It's been a depressing story, news thing. Jeanette Viala asks, does democracy have any hope after Brnovich? And Sakashite Fukuzumi adds, sure it does. Oh, you mean in the United States? Then no.
So it's interesting. I actually turned my head because I was I keep on my third monitor stories that I'll read throughout the week that I like will put aside and be like, oh, maybe I want to come back to this for either for OA or for cleanup. And this was the testimony of Nicholas Bowie, Harvard Law professor, to the Presidential Commission on Reforming the Supreme Court. I was actually reading it right, you know, before we got on the Q&A. And it's part of kind of the larger answer to, did you say it was Valerie's question?
What did I say? Jeanette,
sorry. The predicate of Jeanette's question is, the Brnovich decision is super bad, and it is, right? And it will empower the states that have been taken off of preclearance to do exactly what they've done, right? Which is try and suppress the vote in ways that will pass muster. And we break this down. Patrons, you'll get the show probably tonight, Monday, right? And then, and it's on Tuesday show.
No holidays for the editor.
Nope. So we talk about Brnovich and it's super bad. What's going to happen in the future is this meta discussion has now kind of percolated up to the top. And it's what reminded me of the Bowie testimony that I wanted to come back. And basically, like, but Bowie's argument here is we need to rethink this whole judicial review thing. And we need to rethink it in light of what are the fundamental goals in a democracy, right? Like, what is it when we say like we live in a democracy? What does that mean? And look, like there is a really, really good argument that says, yeah, when 99% of your congressional districts have been gerrymandered to protect an incumbent of either party, like. How democratic is that, right?
Yeah.
It just isn't. So my hope for democracy is by getting that meta discussion going and having us talk about like what are the fundamental goals of the rules we use to structure society. Brnovich is super bad, and you'll hear that on Tuesday.
Yeah, I forgot that the listeners hadn't heard that depressing segment. I just finished editing it. So that's why it's fresh on my mind, but I haven't finished the whole show yet. Okay, let's see. Here we go. Chris asks, why are arbitration clauses allowed to include class action waivers? If there are hundreds of people with the same complaint, surely it would be more efficient to sort it all out in a single trial. Is there a legitimate reason why class action waivers would be beneficial to society, or is this just a case of the corporate world bribing Congress? I don't really, you're going to have to explain this. I don't totally understand what's going on here.
Yeah. Simple answer, because there's a Supreme Court decision that says they can, right? but here's what happens, right? Your contract and extending all the way to like, you know, your end user licensing agreement, right? So not just an employment contract, but any contract you have, may contain an arbitration clause, right? And say, you agree to give up your right to a civil suit, and to arbitrate this, through private arbitration. That can include there are some things, and this varies state by state, so it's not really possible to give kind of an overarching rule. There is a strong federal policy in favor of arbitration. California has been sort of the most aggressive in terms of challenging mandatory, forced arbitration, basically in take it or leave it contracts, right? Where, you know, I litigated this where it contained the arbitration clause in an employment agreement required you to arbitrate before a 3-judge panel at the, you know, International Grievance Commission in Switzerland.
There's three demons at the seventh circle.
Right. Yeah. But like, you know, we did, you know, what we pled in the California court was, this was a person, you know, working as an accountant making, you know, I'm making up the numbers here, like $150,000 salary as a highly compensated executive. This was almost 20 years ago. And the filing fees in Switzerland would have been like $190,000, right? Like, yeah, it was just, look, this is oppressive. This is meant to deny people any meaningful recourse. Usually, if we had not been in California, that argument would have failed, right? They would have been like, yeah, I know, but, you know, didn't have to work there if you don't, right? Like a lot of really, really bad.
Yeah, exactly. Because you don't need to work. It's easy to just say, I'll not work.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, look,
not oppressive at all.
I love that we're getting that, by the way, you know, in the minimum wage pool right
well,
now.
Well, yeah, actually, that's an interesting policy thing. Like, people have said that we don't actually have to increase the minimum wage to 15. We can just make it so that it's not worth it for anybody to work below that amount by having good, like, unemployment and other things. It's kind of interesting that that's almost happening a little bit.
Yeah. So it is very, very beneficial for employers to put in class action waivers, because class actions are strongly incentivize plaintiffs' firms to take those cases on a contingent fee basis. And the name of the New York firm, but literally it's like one of the best firms in New York. There are
Rudy Giuliani's law firm. What's that one
Giuliani
called?
Bracewell. Yeah. Right. No.
What is it? Fraud guarantee.
But there are top-notch Covington level law firms that will take big class action cases on a contingent fee basis, and they won't do anything else on a contingent fee basis, right? So if you are a multinational corporation, if you are, you know, a Fortune 100 company, you really, really do not want somebody to be able to have access to, you know, the best law firm in the country incentivized to bring a huge class action and then get 40% of, you know, the judgment. That's why those firms do it, right? It can pay off for them.
So basically, this is another thing that helps the company who has the arbitration clause.
Yep, absolutely.
Cool. Hey, I want to answer a chat one just for fun. This is – so I don't think I've heard an actual clown horn on the show for ages. Did the clown send a cease and desist? So here's the thing. Here's the funny thing about this. The time you stopped hearing clown horns was when I took back over editing the show. Brian was a clown horn fan. That sounds funny now that clown horn means a curse for us. Brian was a clown horn fan. I've always been more of a bleep fan. But here's the funny thing. I think we can kind of marry the two, you know. Mm-hmm. I love saying clown horn, but I don't like how it sounds in the place of a expletive. It just sounds off to me. I don't like it. It sounds like people who don't listen to the show are going to be like, what in the world just happened? Like, did something go off in someone's house? Whereas the bleep is, I find the bleep satisfying, you know? Like, the bleep is the best way to still get in the punch of the curse word, you know? It's like, bleep, you know, it still feels like you really got it in there. So, I like saying clown horn. We keep that in, and it's a nice marriage of the two, so. I think that's a good way to do it. I love it. Okay. Drew Vogel asks, this seems like a weird question, but it's got 12 hearts. Here we go. Could the government use the power of eminent domain to obtain a copy of Red Map? It seems like most eminent domain case law revolves around taking physical property. It's almost exclusively about cases where the location of a property forces an issue. From EP, from EP 500, it sounds like the government could take any type of property so long as they have a compelling interest and compensate the aggrieved party. On the other hand, since the original owner is no longer deprived of the use of any part of the software, is it actually a taking? Oh, that's snuck in a really interesting question at the last sentence there.
I love the question. Let me tell you, I have never seen a case in which eminent domain, in which the Fifth Amendment was held to apply in that context to intellectual property, right? And for the reason that you've described, like it seems really, really difficult to come up with a justification of the power that would include, right, extinguishing your rights, right? Like I can certainly come up with cases in which, you know, the government has required companies to turn over source code, right? Like in criminal investigations, right? In antitrust investigations, right? But you would still have the same copy, right? So it's not, it does not become a taking. You have not been deprived of the use of it. So I don't want to say that eminent domain only applies to physical property. I will say I have only ever read cases and I've read a lot of cases involving physical property. I am sure we'll put this out here.
Eminent domain?
I've never seen it. I could be wrong.
Because I could see like apps or, you know, like actually, yeah, why couldn't they have kind of tried to do that with the whole iPhone cracking thing with the terrorism that they, you know, the other, that was under Obama, I guess, right? Yeah. Where they're trying to get Apple to, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. Like, yep. It seems like you could be like, well, we're eminent domaining this algorithm or whatever.
So, and to be clear, right, Peter Gerdes has asked some questions and thrown up some hypotheticals in the chat. I'm not saying the Fifth Amendment, broadly speaking, doesn't apply to all forms of – it does, right? The Fifth Amendment, right – applies to intellectual property in the sense that the government can't, you know, just take it, you know, couldn't take it without a search warrant, for example, right?
You're like just saying you haven't seen a case.
I'm saying I have not seen eminent domain as a physical takings applied to anything other than real property. So yes, there are tons of property cases that involve IP. So if that wasn't clear.
Okay. Yeah, I just think it would be funny if you took it from Republicans and you're like, well, we got to compensate them. It's not like they make money on this. They just get like one fascism. So we have to like give them one fascism back. Like, here, we took your red map. In return, we'll pay you the market rate, which is one killing of democracy. We'll just give you that one of those. Yeah.
You can use this to overthrow one second world government of your choice. It's a get out of international criminal court free. Yeah.
Oh God, I'm going to try to not start coughing. Whew. I hit that cough button for a couple. All right. This is, I love this question. Hausdorff asks, I get that the wheels of justice move slowly, but is it too slow? Why do we need years-long investigations for crimes that they admit to in public or just do the crime in full view of everyone? At what point is it too slow, Andrew? I feel like this is – you need an answer for this.
Yeah. Again, if you want to take the entire 4 years, Trump years of opening arguments as one long Andrew was wrong, like it – There used to be consequences for elected officials who crossed a line, right? Like the best bad analogy I can come up with is, you know, you will see these stories about the, like, you know, unwritten rules of baseball and how stupid that is, right? Like, you know, Tony La Russa being like, you know, how dare that kid, you know, hit a home run when you're up by 8 runs, and you're like, Tony, shut up, right?
You know, sorry, I just, because it is an interesting hockey story for 2 seconds that I thought of. People do this attitude with the hockey, too. When one team's really ahead, they're like, and they're still trying to score. And I'm always like, I just want to fucking play hockey out here. Like, I would rather if the other team were ahead and they started not trying, I'd be more annoyed at that. Like, I would rather just everybody play and we get to play a game. It's not the pros. We're out here to just play anyway. Like, why would you care if they're ahead? You can still try. So it's that same kind of unwritten rule with the baseball thing where you're like, just, you're here to play the game. Stats are a thing, you know, career stats are a thing that people should care about. Anyway.
And again, right, the instant answer back to anyone who asserts the unwritten rules is like, yeah, look, if you want to, like, agree that you, you know, won't try and come back in this game, then great. You know,
yeah.
You know, otherwise, you're going to try and win. We're going to try and win. Yeah. Thank you. So, I bring that up because I think there was a tension that where for a long time, you know, we believed that the unwritten rules of politics, would be a sufficient deterrent. And they clearly are not. And we have now reached like a hyper partisan polarization that, is, you know, like I said, I mean, resolving the problem of, you know, where if you phrase the question as, right, Joe Biden and the Democrats agree that the sun orbits the earth. Do you agree with them? Right. You will get 40% opposition in the polls. Right. Because, you know, that question of identity has, you know, superseded absolutely everything.
But I didn't even take Hausdorff to be talking about stuff like the impeachment and all that. Like, just even the New York stuff going on right now with the Trump org and the, mm-hmm. and the, by the way, Georgia that you thought, you know, like stuff like that, where it's not that, you know, Congress is stopping it. It's, why is that stuff taking so long, Andrew?
Well, like, look, we're probably going to talk about this next week. Yeah. No. But like, look, if you look at the Weisselberg indictment, right, and we touched this, you know, super briefly on Friday's show, but because it came down literally as we were recording, but I've posted it on, you know, to the Opening Arguments website. That is a really, really good indictment, right? It is airtight, lock solid, and you know that buttresses the primary point that I was making, which is if what you want to do, right? Like, I use this construction of language a lot, but I will say, you know, if what you want to do is flip Alan Weisselberg to testify against Trump, this is the way that you would do that, right? And it is, you know, forget what anybody else, you know, and Trump did a rally and was like, I don't pay taxes on benefits all the time. And you're like, which I think maybe inspired some of the question. But like, so I can't prove that this indictment will be used to flip Weisselberg.
Right.
But
just saying in today's environment, it's like they have to be even, you know, cross every T even more, dot every I even more. To make it's not they do you think they're even more paranoid about like this has to be totally airtight because otherwise it's going to be looked at as a political hit job?
Because you look at the jury that hung on 10 counts against Paul Manafort,
right? Yeah.
So I am sure, and not just I am sure. I talk to prosecutor friends all the time, and I ask them like, how terrified are you that like you're going to get some MAGA hat wear? And they're like, 100%. That's the thing that keeps us up at night. So,
here's a fun, depressing one. Assault with a battery not included. Which do you think is more likely, Stephen Breyer retiring while Democrats hold the Senate, or have Joe Manchin agree to blow up the filibuster?
So I'll give you the serious answer, which is I think there's probably more movement potential for Manchin.
I was going to say the same thing if I weren't having a coughing fit.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Yep.
I have a mute button.
And again, right, Stephen
Breyer. The Breyer stuff is unbelievable. Like, what are you doing?
He's 82 years old and, you know, has had a job for life. for as long as he can possibly remember. And so I think that there is, you know, it is really acute to us to say, you know, the clock is running out, like, you know, within a very short period of time, you know, that seat could get McConnell'd again from us. But that does not seem to concern him. Being in a perpetual minority at age, like, you know, the Kennedy retiring was very clear to me that like, he looked at, and if you look at the trajectory of Kennedy opinions, sort of pre, when it seemed like Hillary Clinton was going to win, you saw a bunch of like centrist Kennedy opinions in early 2016. And I think he was preparing for life as just like, a member of the Supreme Court and not like the key vote on everything. And then, you know, when it went back to when Trump won and it went back to like, oh, Anthony Kennedy, like what the law is what Anthony Kennedy says the law is. I think it was clear that he got tired of being that guy. Right. And that, and that that's what drove him to retire. And it's clear, like, Breyer, I don't know, like if I were 82 when watching the disintegration of democracy around me, and I'm like, oh, great, another day, another, you know, blistering dissent in the minority, I would be like, you know what, maybe it is like time to spend time.
It feels like
with
he's got his head in the sand, though. Like the quotes you see, he's like, well, the institution is still whatever. And you're like, what world news are you watching? What dimension are you in, Breyer? You know, I haven't followed Breyer's health as much as I did, with Ginsburg. Sorry, I'm just no brain. Has he had like 12 cancers and all these different things? Like, should we be really worried? He seems healthy at least. Like, maybe he will make it to another Democratic Senate some other time if we still have such a thing.
I don't know.
Who knows?
I have tried not to like play the macabre with that.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Here's one with 16 hearts.
Ooh,
that's quite a few. Don't judge a law book by its cover up. How would DC statehood affect the DC federal circuit court? If nobody lived in the federal district, would there be types of cases which suddenly cannot be brought anywhere? If DC had been made a state prior, would there be anywhere else that the DC v. Heller suit could have been brought? That's a really interesting question. I love it.
Great, great set of questions there. So let's tackle kind of each of them individually. First, the Court of Appeals for the DC Circuit also handles Court of Federal Claims cases, right? So there would still be cases for that circuit to hear. You would still have a federal court sitting in DC, right? You would still have the DDC. So it would still have all of those cases. So it would not affect the federal court process, whether it's a state or whether it's a territory. The second part of the question was, if no one lives in the federal district, right? If it is just defined as to include the monuments so as to get around the repeal of the 23rd Amendment, would there be types of cases which can't be brought anywhere because nobody lives there? I think no, right? Like, I think that, you know, you would have – it would still be possible, right? Like if you slipped and fell at the Lincoln Memorial, right? Like. Even though you don't live
Lincoln
there. Yeah, you can sue Lincoln. Right. Yeah. So I don't think it would affect subject matter jurisdiction either. The last part I want to talk about, because there really is sort of an interesting question there. And that was.
DC v. Heller.
DC
My
v.
guess
Heller.
Was going to be that that couldn't have happened if it was a state. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. It would have made the bar slightly higher, right? So what would have happened was...
there's a reason that that didn't happen in a state, right? It only happened in D.C.
But here's why, right? NRA activists were looking for long-standing handgun bans to challenge. And they had identified the D.C. gun ban and the Chicago gun ban, which came up a year later. The obstacle was because there was so little Second Amendment jurisprudence and because the Second Amendment has never been read the way these idiots want it and now have required it to be read, it was not a right that was incorporated to the states. So what you would have is had the McDonald case challenging the Chicago handgun ban come first, you would have had to have won on two arguments. Now, you still would have won on those arguments, right? They would have been, number one, the Second Amendment is a right that is incorporated out to the states by the 14th Amendment. And number two, that this violates the Second Amendment. So you still could have brought the same case. There are only a handful of rights that have not been enumerated out. And the only one of any significance that I can think of that would change practice is the right to be indicted by a grand jury. Eliminating DC as or granting statehood to the District of Columbia and thus getting rid of a case that can be brought without the incorporation doctrine would affect a potential future lawsuit challenging grand juries. But there isn't much left. And somebody in the chat may know, some of our lawyers in the chat may know the handful of other rights that are still unincorporated. Whenever you get an incorporation decision, there's a footnote and it'll list like five or six of them. But grand juries is pretty much the last one standing. Stormy Decisis says the right not to quarter soldiers in your house. I have no idea if the Third Amendment has been incorporated to the states.
Oh, I hope so. Otherwise, I'm going to have to, you know, let this battalion in that's been knocking down my door. Okay. This is a question that has curious number of hearts. It's weird that so many people are interested, maybe. Okay. Maury Yar asks, I've been commissioned as a notary public and I'm having difficulty locating ways to put my commission to recreational use. Do you have any advice on this matter? What?
I mean, you know, professional use, it's a,
yeah, that's
that's a tough gig, right? Like, you know, at $8 a pop. So just in case any of our listeners don't know this, the function of a notary is to witness and attest to the validity
just had
of
one
signatures
for my refi. So my answer was going to be contact a you know, real estate business, you know, agency or whatever, and just see if you can be their person.
Yeah,
but that's not recreational, so I don't understand the question.
Recreational, you know, being able to identify signatures does not strike me as something that has a whole lot of recreational possibilities to it. But, you know, I'd be creative. I like it.
Weird. Okay, we got some Torres law firm question here. Justin asks, is Morgan the only associate employed with Andrew's law firm, or are there other associates who haven't reached the ACE podcast ready level yet? Well, it's time to shit on your other associates. They haven't made ACE.
Yeah, no, Morgan is our only associate. And let me talk about this a little bit, right? Because I think people sort of don't understand. I think there's a lot that they don't understand. Number one, a small law practice is not like, I mean, there's a reason that I have a hole in my wall in the basement here, right? Like, a small law practice is not a license to print money. The field that I got into is representing small businesses, which I think I'm good at. And I think, you know, there's really a niche in the marketplace. But you know, these are companies that cannot afford, you know, huge monthly legal bills, right? So, you know, you got to maintain your relationships. You got to do that work. And then you have to balance that work with, you know, the fact that I do the show. So every once in a while I will get like, I need to say this as prefatory. Our patrons are awesome and amazing and we love you. Every once in a great while, someone will be like, you know, well, you're a lawyer. Why should I, you know, why should I send you a book? I can make better use of that. That's 100% true, right? Like you probably could, right? But, everything I do on the show, right, is something that makes it impossible for me to do more work with the firm, right? And, you know, with particular, and like, that's not a problem that you can solve by bringing on associates, right? Like you've got to supervise that work and get it done. So I am very, very fortunate.
It's a weird way of looking at it. I think we need to get to just talking about the Patreon part of, we should probably get to a phase of podcasting that's more like everything else. You know, nobody's like, well, does Netflix need my money? You know, it's like, no, either they have the things you want to watch or not. And that's kind of how I approach, you know, I hope that we give people enough benefits on Patreon that they want to do it. And if they don't, they don't, you know, and that's kind of how I look at it. I think we, you know, give people a lot of Patreon benefits and And that's what we like to do. So that's how I look at it with my podcast that I'm a patron of as well. It's like, actually, no, that's not true. There are some that I try to support because, you know, like the small podcasts, you know, support local podcasts. But others, it's like, well, I just love this one. And yes, I'm the 10,000th patron or something. I don't really, you know, like it doesn't matter. I just like this show kind of thing.
Yeah. So anyway, I just want to circle back and say that, you know, I've been very, very fortunate with the folks who have expressed an interest in coming forward and in having good arrangements. Like, it takes a special kind of lawyer to want to work for me in this environment, you know, and to have somebody who has, you know, Morgan's level of intelligence is just, you know, I could not be more fortunate to have her on board. So.
Yeah. Stormy, I don't think this is right. It's not as though if Netflix had all the same lineup, but like was like a mom and pop business, would that change? You'd be like, okay, I will pay for it. Isn't just like what shows you want to watch on? I get that we don't want to give these companies money. I understand. I'm not saying that. But like, we either do or don't based on if they have a thing that we want. Like I subscribe to all those damn streaming platforms because I end up having to watch some movie on it anyway for either Lot Awful Movies or one of my other shows. But anyway, all right. On to the hardcore legal questions here.
All right.
Depressing political questions. Jeanette again asks, is there any point to passing the For the People Act or the John Lewis Voting Rights Act with the current SCOTUS makeup, or is court packing the only solution?
I can't tell you that despair is an inappropriate emotional reaction, right? Like, it's a perfectly rational response to where the Supreme Court is right now, and it's why structural reform is high on the agenda. It's high on the Biden administration's agenda. That being said, absolutely, right? Like, again, there are things that you can't just read out of the law, the provisions of the For the People Act that preempt state legislation that require districts be drawn in a particular way. Like, those are incredibly valuable provisions. Will this court do its best to gut any legislative accomplishment that Biden comes up with? 100%, right? They've told you that that's what they're going to do. They have openly written law review articles about how they can't wait to end the administrative state and to make, you know, government work less. That's part of their fundamental ideology. So, you know, yes, a lot of despair is welcome, but like that does not invalidate the need for legislation. It just means we need to do both.
Yeah. I'm just not sure. I wanted to ask you, I know it's a big question, but like, what are the things that, do you think there are things that if Congress were able to pass one of these voting rights acts or some version of a whatever, are there things that they might put in there that the court might just strike down? Or is it that somewhere down the line, Alito will decide some stupid fucking sentence meant something it didn't, you know, like, do you think there's stuff they would actually, are they that radical that they'd be like, no, you can't, we'll find some bullshit justification to say that like, you actually can't even regulate elections in states or something, you know?
Yeah. So I think the answer to that is, right, look at the court's Obamacare decisions, right? Like, and we talked about that. The idea that you could pass legislation that radically regulates interstate market for healthcare and that five justices of the Supreme Court would say, well, that doesn't seem to be commerce, interstate commerce, is baffling beyond words. And, you know, and sort of yet, and that's where we were a decade ago. So, I could see, right? And there are grounds to say, like, look, in general, states have plenary power over how to conduct their elections, right? Like
fetuses have an Eighth Amendment right to be discriminatory in voting in elections. Oh, no, I'm combining things.
But good combination. So
states have a right to discriminate against certain peoples. But yeah, I've, So I don't know. I mean, but there is still a lot that could be done and that would be really transformative about a voting rights bill, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and, so still and, worth doing.
And look, like, remember that the, you know, what we talk about with Brnovich is the death of a thousand cuts. Mm-hmm. So preempting that, right, saying that state legislation has to fit within certain predefined parameters, right, makes it harder for them to do those things. So, and that's a good thing.
All righty. Here's a question. A question this far down with this many hearts is impressive. Resident wow. Stevel, have you ever thought of doing a Ken Starr special? From his abuses of power of the OIC to his deal-making for Jeffrey Epstein to his cover-up of sexual abuse at Baylor, there's plenty of material. He doesn't get the scrutiny he so deserves. That's totally true. That guy is a real piece of crap.
I love it. That's a fantastic idea, and let me add that to the whiteboard.
Yeah,
right,
it's
now.
Not exactly our show, like, this person sucks, yeah. But I don't know. Kind of, I don't know. Maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not saying we don't do it. I'm just saying that may be why we haven't done a thing.
Yeah,
that's specifically,
I don't
like,
think it would have occurred, but, like, you know, it's a fair, you know, deep dive on Ken Starr. I like that. I'm adding it right now.
And he, you know, like, utilized his, like, Christianity and the Bill Clinton stuff so much. And then he, like, is just awful at the same time. The hypocrisy, yep. You know.
I will tell you, since you guys are here in the chat, we'll let you know. I just put it under the
eminent domain.
I just put it under the what Trump got right, which came in. Somebody sent us a question, and
what
I
Trump
love,
got what? Sorry, I was coughing.
Got right. You know. Oh. So, is there anything? What would we find in kind of a retroactive review of the Trump administration that you know was sort of worth doing? And I don't know what that answer is. It could be nothing, right? But I love
there may be some things, but just speaking like what epistemologically or something. Like, it's not to me. It's not important to find the times where a total chaotic, you know, asshole happened to get the right answer. That's not a the methodology he was utilizing is worthless. You know what I mean? So it's like, let's just try to do the correct things ourselves and not worry about whether or not he accidentally got something right.
Yes. Yeah.
But, okay. Here's one that's kind of related to another one, but, it has so many hearts. I want to make sure we ask it. General Contact Unit Problem Child asks, will the truth be any kind of defense against these new anti-CRT laws in court? Like, suppose you're a history lecturer in a community college in Florida and you teach that cultural and institutional racism was a major contributory factor to why the U.S. didn't elect a black president until more than 40 years after the Voting Rights Act was passed. If you end up in court for violating the anti-CRT laws, would the fact that the thing you're teaching is demonstrably true be any kind of defense?
So I love the question. It obviously, GCU Problem Child is making the analogy to, you know, truth being a defense in defamation mm-hmm. cases. I think what I would analogize this to are the periodic court cases regarding creationism and intelligent design and that sort of thing, and that ascertaining what proper education is, right, is often, you know, kind of goes hand in hand with figuring out whether something is being offered up for an improper purpose, right? And so, you know, to say, like, hey, look, like, here's what the science of biology is, and by contrasting that with the absolute nonsense that the Discovery Institute puts out, we can demonstrate that the intent in adding intelligent design to the curriculum is an intent to put religion in the classroom, right? And that was true in Epperson versus Arkansas. That was the 1986 creationism case. That's why the Pennsylvania case, the Hazelwood Independent School District. That's why that case has like a 70-page discussion on like what science is, right? So. Mm. I do think in the event that happened, you would have like an instruction on like what historical pedagogy is. These laws are not making it there. These laws are so preposterously, unenforceably unconstitutional. You know, it's laughable. But yes, I mean, you know, good in sort of thinking about it that way.
Well, we're out of time, and given my current condition, I'm not too keen to go extra, but I will just do one more question. Here we go.
We missed a Jared Novak lightning round.
Yeah, this is the lightning round here. Mickey Mouse, Steamboat Willie copyright is going to expire in just a few years. How is Disney not freaking out about this? I bet they are. I found a lot of conflicting arguments about Mickey's true introduction, Mickey as a trademark versus creative work and other nuance. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. I agree with you that they are very likely freaking out about it. I also think that it is important to differentiate between a particular copyright on a work versus the ongoing intellectual property rights that you have in, you know, the derivative works that you've created from that, which can then, you know, get their own copyright. So in other words, if Steamboat Willie goes into the public domain, that's exactly what that means, right? People will be able to show Steamboat Willie and make derivative Steamboat Willie material in the same way that you can make, you know, derivative, you know, Huckleberry Finn material,
yeah.
Right? But it does not mean Disney will lose the copyright on Mickey Mouse.
Okay.
So, you know, but I could go into a lot more on that.
Steamboat pretty shit as a cartoon now anyway.
Yeah, so that's the thing.
Not really a big loss.
and I wonder if some of the efforts to like redo, so, like they've incorporated some of the Steamboat Willie mythology into some recent Disney works, if I'm not mistaken. And that may be a way of kind of
try to re-up it.
Yeah. Of effectively copywriting something that is different enough from the material, but will get you some of those protections. But this is a really neat, I may add this to the whiteboard too. It's a super interesting question. And you know, it's kind of rare to have something be, you know, a billion-dollar commodity in our lifetime that is coming from a literary work. Yeah.
Is that the Speed 2? What's the Speed 2 one? Is that International Waters or is that just Speed 2? It might just be Speed 2.
It was Speed – yeah, I don't think Speed 2.
Can I tell you, because of my age, I saw Speed 2 before Speed 1. Like,
oh, wow.
I wasn't old enough – because I want to say that Speed – was that rated R? I don't know. For some reason, I couldn't see Speed, but Speed 2, I think, was PG-13. And also, I think it had Sandra Bullock in it. So,
well, Speed 1 had Sandra Bullock.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm blanking. Yeah, no, I think Speed 2 also did. Oh. She stayed, but what's his name didn't. Anyway. Oh, Cruise Control. Is it really Cruise Control? Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
So
it could be. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, no Keanu.
Man.
I have to say, I'm an unapologetic fan of action movies that, you know, that was a
especially with Keanu.
They hit their heyday in the 80s, right? So I'm a huge fan. And I think Speed works great as an action movie.
Yeah,
right?
No, it's great. I think one of my favorite all-time Simpsons joke is like, whoa, it's like Speed 2, but with a bus instead of a boat.
That made me think of that other Simpsons, which was Night Boat.
Night like, Boat. Oh, what is that?
It was a fictional Simpsons spinoff of Knight Rider, and it was Night Boat. And then you hear Bart say like, "Oh man, it's another episode with a canal," and Elisa's like, "They always have a canal or a fjord or whatever." It was super funny.
That's funny. Anyway. Now that we're on the Simpsons topic, there's also the like Itchy and Scratchy Steamboat Willie that they do, the first Itchy and Scratchy. Yeah.
It's called Steamboat Itchy, if I remember.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Oh, man, those episodes were great. That was a lot of fun, everybody. Happy slaveholders who didn't want to pay taxes day, as I said, which is the weirdest thing. I saw in my Facebook memories, I said that last year, and it turns out it's like an exact quote from a movie I've never seen. The weirdest thing. But whatever. Great minds. thanks so much, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
Until then.